Welcome to the Alpha One edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the Alpha One antitrypsin deficiency community.
Hello, everybody. This is Larry Luxner, senior correspondent with Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking today with Dr. Mark Brantley, scientific director of the Miami-based Alpha One Foundation. Dr. Brantley, a professor of medicine, molecular genetics, and microbiology, is also the vice chair of research at the Department of Medicine within the University of Florida in Gainesville. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Brantley. Let's start by asking you a bit about the Alpha One Foundation and how you came to be associated with this nonprofit organization.
Well, it's always great to talk about the Alpha One Foundation. It was started a little over 25 years ago by three alphas with the help of the scientific guidance of several of us who are interested in alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. The concept was to basically take donated dollars and turn them into research for a cure for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. It's been very successful, and more than $81 million has been donated to date for research in alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency.
How prevalent is alpha-1, also known as AATD, and does this disease affect any particular ethnic group or nationality, as some rare diseases often do?
The concept is it is a rare disease, less than 200,000 people in the United States, and about 200,000 also in Europe as well. About 1 in 4,000 individuals that are of Caucasian descent. The vast majority of individuals that have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency are Caucasian, though we do see it in African Americans here in the United States.
And when was this first diagnosed and isolated as a separate disorder?
It was discovered as a separate disorder in 1963 by a very smart gastroenterologist by the name of Sten Erickson.
Can you just talk a bit about how you personally came to be associated with alpha-1?
When I was a chief medical resident, I came across a 35-year-old man that had devastating emphysema, and it was really hard to explain in that he'd only smoked for about 7 or 8 pack years at the time, and I became fascinated with this clinical case, discovered that he had alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency by the appropriate diagnosis back then, and I fell in love with the concept of being able to treat this condition at the time. I went to National Institutes of Health, who was just starting a nascent alpha-1 antitrypsin deficient study on individuals, and really have not looked back since then.
And what about the development of therapies over time? Can you just talk about that?
Alpha-1 antitrypsin, from the very beginning, when we noticed that it was a 5-fold decrease in alpha-1 antitrypsin in people's blood, the thought was that we might be able to purify human alpha-1 antitrypsin as a plasma side product to basically give back to people that were deficient from that standpoint. That work started very early on in the very early 80s, and by 1988 was an approved therapy from the FDA.
Initially, as I understand, these therapies were infusions, correct?
That's correct. Early on, when we started giving infusions, we had considered giving inhaled alpha-1 antitrypsin. And indeed, there has been some early studies in dogs giving inhaled alpha-1 antitrypsin that were very successful from that standpoint. And that spurred us on from that standpoint. I've been particularly interested in inhaled alpha-1 antitrypsin because it makes sense to directly deliver the drug to basically affected organ by an aerosol, where we can get much higher doses of alpha-1 antitrypsin than we can give by IV alpha-1 antitrypsin.
At the moment, how many therapies are actually approved by the FDA to treat alpha-1?
Still, there are three major manufacturers that make IV alpha-1 antitrypsin at the present time. We still only have the current therapy, which is 60 milligrams per kilogram of alpha-1 antitrypsin available to give people IV. There are a number of other potential therapies that are in this space using even plasma products at the present time.
What is the quality of life of people affected by this disease?
Well, the quality of life is obviously, it's a complex issue in a lot of different ways. But as you lose lung function, the quality of life tends to diminish over time with people's inability to be able to accomplish some of the things that they want to. I find it quite remarkable, particularly in this group of individuals where oftentimes, even with lung function of 20% predicted, some people are still working and have lived quite full lives from that standpoint. I'd have to say that in my space, I see very courageous patients every day that have a smile on their face, even though their lung function is substantially down.
Can you recall any particular patient stories that stand out in your mind?
Well, I think that one of the things that's striking about alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency in general is that there's a wide spectrum of lung damage among individuals. And I've seen patients, I've cared for patients that are 80 years old, and their major complaint is they can't dance as well as they used to be able to do. I recall one set of brothers that I saw when they were in their early 30s that unfortunately I was not able to convince them to quit smoking. And they returned again a decade later, and both were seriously impaired and were on disability because of that from that standpoint. Reminding me that in the right circumstances, progression of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency to the devastating lung disease is quite quick. And that's the reason why early diagnosis and then appropriate therapies is incredibly important.
And in addition to lung damage, there's also liver damage.
That's correct. And the second clinical manifestation of alpha-1 antitrypsin is lung disease. And indeed, there's been a couple of myths that have been propagated over many years is that you can only have the lung disease or the liver disease. But we've discovered in some studies that we've done with Dr. Ginger Clark that individuals with lung disease can develop liver disease as well from that standpoint. It looks like about 35 to 36% of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficient individuals at any one time, even though they don't show signs of liver disease, actually have liver fibrosis already from that standpoint.
You mentioned smoking, and you mentioned the case of twins that you treated and you were not able to convince them to quit. How prevalent is smoking among people with alpha-1?
I'd say that fortunately it's been decreasing substantially over time from that standpoint. One of the things is, and I would say that perhaps the majority of individuals that have lung disease have smoked at some point, but we now see people that don't smoke at all that have developed. And one of the reminders is that passive smoking plays a role in lung damage as well. So sometimes patients who had never smoked but had been in a household where people smoked actually develop lung damage as well from that standpoint.
Are there any other risk factors besides presence of smoke that could contribute to alpha-1?
Passive smoking is number two. And then occupational diseases also play a role as well. And interestingly enough, I used to care for a pediatrician that his lungs were very damaged, not because he smoked, because he was exposed to constant infections over time from that standpoint, which is really one of the third things that people can get from that standpoint.
On the subject of infections, thank you, because I wanted to ask about coronavirus. The town hall meeting that's featured in this upcoming conference is on COVID-19 and vaccines. Can you give us a summary of what will be discussed?
Interesting enough, from the AlphaNet experience, which will be hopefully published or submitted for publication soon, the vast majority of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficient individuals have not gotten COVID-19. Probably because, number one, they were very high alert for COVID-19, routinely masked anyway, and took the recommendations very well to basically isolate during the first stages of the pandemic at that time. For those people that do get COVID, they do sometimes have more severe disease, and we've unfortunately lost about 5 alpha-1 antitrypsin deficient individuals, at least here in the United States, from the AlphaNet cohort from that standpoint. They do tend to be hospitalized at a slightly higher rate, but that rate is not too high just because of the protective mechanism that they have from that standpoint.
Are you going to address the issue of vaccines and whether alpha-1 patients should be vaccinated or
absolutely.
Should not
be? Absolutely. So, and I would say that the vast majority of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficient individuals from this survey that Dr. Sandhaus and Dr. Strange did indicated that they had been vaccinated by one of the three available vaccines here in the United States from that standpoint. Compliance is extremely high on vaccinations, and they were, unfortunately, the way the United States did it, it was a little bit slow to focus on diseases, but by June of 2020, most individuals were vaccinated.
Are you finding any vaccine resistance among alpha-1 patients?
I have not encountered any, but they might be afraid to talk to me because I'm pretty strong about that. But the other thing I just wanted to mention in COVID-19 is I did have a couple of patients that were alpha-1 antitrypsin deficient that developed COVID after we had already developed the monoclonal antibodies for treating. And those appeared to be life-saving in my two patients from that standpoint to give monoclonal. So it's a reminder that we have, if you treat very early with the monoclonal antibodies, we can prevent serious disease.
That makes sense. What are your thoughts about the booster shot being considered now by the FDA?
Well, I think the data is still out on the booster shots from that standpoint. As I'm sure you're aware, there's a controversy right now. The WHO asked first world nations not to vaccinate for booster yet. I think I'd sort of step back from the politics and say there's not enough evidence to show that it truly does increase protection. It surely increases antibody, but I don't believe that early data is showing that it increases the quality of antibody anymore from that standpoint. So I think there are experiments going on, and we will probably find that out not too long.
The University of Florida has an excellent center for gene therapy, and I wanted to ask about the potential for gene therapy to treat alpha-1 in the future.
I've actually been in the gene therapy space since 1983, when it was still sort of a very, very early plan. Alpha-1-antitrypsin is the number of efforts that have been made and a number of projects have been done, including with myself and Terry Flott and many other individuals in alpha-1-antitrypsin gene therapy. It's been resistant to gene therapy up till now, and we will probably move more into gene therapies related to CRISPR and ADAR, a number of other things that are basically direct changes of an individual's genes rather than giving it by a virus from that standpoint. It's more tricky to use viral vectors, which are the most advanced gene therapy tools that we have, because alpha-1-antitrypsin is a bulk protein. We need a lot of it. And so gene therapy is really good at getting small amounts of protein to replete people. The examples of the hemophilias are probably the best example, but there are other ones as well.
Great. What other major themes will you be discussing at the upcoming conference?
Well, I mean, I think that we will promote self-care, still being vigilant. Some of our data is just now coming out about the Delta variant at the present time. Most of the data that we have been advising alpha-1-antitrypsin deficient individuals has been based on the Alpha virus. The Delta variant seems to be about 3 or 4 times more infective. It may be may cause more severe disease. The jury's still out on that right now. But I think that we're not going to be able to let our guards down regarding this until we've got everybody vaccinated and we can see this tremendous drops. Unfortunately, here in Florida, we have 1/5 of the cases in the whole United States because of some policy decisions that have been occurred.
On that note, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Brantley, for making time to talk to us today. Thank you very much.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.